lining up for their photographs, I headed for the buffet. As I munched on hors d'oeuvres and engaged in small talk with a handful of House members, I recalled my previous two encounters with the president, the first a brief congratulatory call after the election, the second a small White House breakfast with me and the other incoming senators. Both times I had found the president to be a likable man, shrewd and disciplined, but with the same straightforward manner that had helped him win two elections. You could easily imagine him owning the local car dealership down the street, coaching Little League, and grilling in his backyard, the kind of guy that would make for good company so long as the conversation revolved around sports and the kids. "Senator?" I looked up, shaken out of my memory, and saw one of the older black men who made up most of the White House wait staff standing next to me. "Want me to take that plate for you?" I nodded, trying to swallow a mouthful of chicken something or others, and noticed that the line to greet the president had evaporated. Wanting to thank my hosts, I headed toward the blue room. A young Marine at the door politely indicated that the photograph session was over and that the president needed to get to his next appointment. But before I could turn around to go, the president himself appeared in the doorway and waved me in. "Obama," the president said, shaking my hand. "Come here and meet Laura. Laura, you remember Obama. We saw him on TV during election night. Beautiful family. And that wife of yours, that's one impressive lady." "We both got better than we deserve, Mr. President," I said, shaking the first lady's hand and hoping that I'd wiped any crumbs off my face. The president turned to an aide nearby, who squirted a big dollop of hand sanitizer in the president's hand. "Want some?" the president asked. "Good stuff. Keeps you from getting colds." Not wanting to seem unhygienic, I took a squirt. "Come over here for a second," he said, leading me off to one side of the room. "You know," he said quietly, "I hope you don't mind me giving you a piece of advice." "Not at all, Mr. President." He nodded. "You've got a bright future," he said, "very bright. But I've been in this town a while, and let me tell you, it can be tough. When you get a lot of attention, like you've been getting, people start gunning for you. And it won't necessarily be just coming from my side, you understand. From yours, too. Everybody will be waiting for you to slip. Know what I mean? So watch yourself." "Thanks for the advice, Mr. President." "All right. I gotta get along. You know, me and you got something in common." "What's that?" "We both had to debate Alan Keyes. That guy's a piece of work, isn't he?" I laughed, and as we walked to the door, I told him a few stories from the campaign. It wasn't until he had left the room that I realized I had briefly put my arm over his shoulder as we talked, an unconscious habit of mine, but one that I suspected might have made many of my friends, not to mention the Secret Service agents in the room, more than a little uneasy. Since my arrival in the Senate, I've been a steady and occasionally fierce critic of Bush administration policies. So Democratic audiences are often surprised when I tell them that I don't consider George Bush a bad man, and I assume that he and members of his administration are trying to do what they think is best for the country. I say this not because I'm seduced by the proximity to power. I see my invitations to the White House for what they are, exercises in common political courtesy, and am mindful of how quickly the long knives can come out when the administration's agenda is threatened in any serious way. Moreover, when I write a letter to a family who's lost a loved one in Iraq, or read an email from a constituent who has dropped out of college because her student aid has been cut, I'm reminded that the actions of those in power have enormous consequences, a price that they themselves almost never have to pay. It is to say that after all the trappings of office, the titles, the staff, the security details are stripped away, I find the president and the men and women who surround him to be pretty much like everyone else, possessed of the same mix of virtues and vices, insecurities and long-buried injuries as the rest of us. No matter how wrong-headed I might consider their policies to be, and no matter how much I might insist that they be held accountable for the results of such policies, I still found it possible, in talking to these men, to understand their motives and to recognize in them values I shared. Outside of Washington, America feels less deeply divided. Illinois, for example, is no longer considered a bellwether state. For more than a decade now, it's become more and more Democratic, partly because of increased urbanization, partly because the social conservatism of today's GOP doesn't wear well in the land of Lincoln. But Illinois remains a microcosm of the country, a rough stew of North and South, east and west, urban and rural, black, white, and everything in between. Chicago may possess all the big city sophistication of L.A. or New York, but geographically and culturally, the southern end of Illinois is closer to Little Rock or Louisville, and large swaths of the state are considered, in modern political parlance, a deep shade of red. I first traveled through southern Illinois in 1997. It was the summer after my first term in the Illinois legislature, and Michelle and I were not yet parents. With session adjourned, no law school classes to teach, and Michelle busy with work of her own, I convinced my aide, Dan Shulman, to toss a map and some golf clubs in the car and tool around the state for a week. Dan had been both a UPI reporter and field coordinator for several downstate campaigns, so he knew the territory pretty well. But as the date of our departure approached, it became apparent that he wasn't quite sure how I would be received in the counties we were planning to visit. Four times he reminded me how to pack. "Just khakis and polo shirts," he said. "No fancy linen trousers or silk shirts." I assured him that I didn't own any linens or silks. We stopped in a coffee shop to eat pie and swap jokes with the mayor of Chester. We posed in front of the 15-foot-tall statue of Superman at the center of Metropolis. We heard about all the young people who were moving to the big cities because manufacturing and coal mining jobs were disappearing. We learned about the local high school football team's prospects for the coming season, and the vast distances veterans had to drive in order to reach the closest VA facility. We met women who had been missionaries in Kenya and greeted me in Swahili, and farmers who tracked the financial pages of the Wall Street Journal before setting out on their tractors. Several times a day, I pointed out to Dan the number of men we met sporting white linen slacks or silk Hawaiian shirts. By the end of the week, I was sorry to leave, not simply because I had made so many new friends, but because in the faces of all the men and women I'd met, I had recognized pieces of myself. In them I saw my grandfather's openness, my grandmother's matter-of-factness, my mother's kindness. The fried chicken, the potato salad, the grape halves in the jello mold, all of it felt familiar. It's that sense of familiarity that strikes me whenever I travel across Illinois. I feel it when I'm sitting down at a diner on Chicago's west side. I feel it as I watch Hispanic men play soccer while their families cheer them on in a park in Pilsen. I feel it when I'm attending an Indian wedding in one of Chicago's northern suburbs. Not so far beneath the surface, I think, we are becoming more, not less, alike. I don't mean to exaggerate here, to suggest that the pollsters are wrong and that our differences, racial, religious, regional, or economic, are somehow trivial. It is to insist that across Illinois and across America, a constant cross-pollination is occurring, a not entirely orderly but generally peaceful collision among people and cultures. Identities are scrambling and then cohering in new ways. Beliefs keep slipping through the noose of predictability. Facile expectations and simple explanations are being constantly upended. Spend time actually talking to Americans, and you discover that most evangelicals are more tolerant than the media would have us believe. Most secularists, more spiritual. Most rich people want the poor to succeed. And most of the poor are both more self-critical and hold higher aspirations than the popular culture allows. Most Republican strongholds are 40% Democrat, and vice versa. The political labels of liberal and conservative rarely track people's personal attributes. All of which raises the question, what are the core values that we, as Americans, hold in common? That's not how we usually frame the issue, of course. Our political culture fixates on where our values clash. In the immediate aftermath of the 2004 election, for example, a major national exit poll was published in which voters ranked moral values as having determined how they cast their ballot. Commentators fastened on the data to argue that the most controversial social issues in the election, particularly gay marriage, had swung a number of states. Conservatives heralded the numbers, convinced that they proved the Christian right's growing power. When these polls were later analyzed, it turned out that the pundits and prognosticators had overstated their case a bit. In fact, voters had considered national security as the most important issue of the race, And although large numbers of voters did consider moral values as an important factor in the way they voted, the meaning of the term was so vague as to include everything from abortion to corporate malfeasance. Immediately, some Democrats could be heard breathing a sigh of relief, as if a diminution in the values factor served the liberal cause, as if a discussion of values was a dangerous, unnecessary distraction from those material concerns that characterized the Democratic Party platform. I think Democrats are wrong to run away from a debate about values, as wrong as those conservatives who see values only as a wedge to pry loose working-class voters from the Democratic base. It is the language of values that people use to map their world. It is what can inspire them to take action and move them beyond their isolation. The post-election polls may have been poorly composed, but the broader question of shared values, the standards and principles that the majority of Americans deem important in their lives and the life of the country, should be at the heart of our politics, the cornerstone of any meaningful debate about budgets and projects, regulations and policies. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those simple words are our starting point as Americans. They describe not only the foundation of our government, but the substance of our common creed. Not every American may be able to recite them. Few, if asked, could trace the genesis of the Declaration of Independence to its roots in 18th century liberal and Republican thought. But the essential idea behind the Declaration, that we are born into this world free, all of us, that each of us arrives with a bundle of rights that can't be taken away by any man or any state without just cause, that through our own agency we can and must make of our lives what we will, is one that every American understands. It orients us, sets our course, each and every day. Indeed, the value of individual freedom is so deeply ingrained in Americans that we tend to take it for granted. It's easy to forget that at the time of the founding, this idea was entirely radical in its implications, as radical as Martin Luther's posting on the church door. It is an idea that some portion of the world still rejects, and for which an even larger portion of humanity finds scant evidence in their lives. At its most elemental level, we understand our liberty in a negative sense. As a general rule, we believe in the right to be left alone, and are suspicious of those, whether big brother or nosy neighbors, who want to meddle in our business. But we understand our liberty in a more positive sense as well, in the idea of opportunity, and the subsidiary values that help realize opportunity. All those homespun virtues that Benjamin Franklin first popularized in Poor Richard's Almanac, and have continued to inspire our allegiance through successive generations. The values of self-reliance and self-improvement and risk-taking, the values of drive, discipline, temperance, and hard work, the values of thrift and personal responsibility. These values are rooted in a basic optimism about life and a faith in free will, a confidence that through pluck and sweat and smarts, each of us can rise above the circumstances of our birth. But these values also express a broader confidence that so long as individual men and women are free to pursue their own interests, society as a whole will prosper. Our system of self-government and our free market economy depend on the majority of individual Americans adhering to these values. The legitimacy of our government and our economy depend on the degree to which these values are rewarded, which is why the values of equal opportunity and non-discrimination complement rather than impinge on our liberty. If we Americans are individualistic at heart, if we instinctively chafe against a past of tribal allegiances, traditions, customs, and castes, it would be a mistake to assume that this is all we are. Our individualism has always been bound by a set of communal values, the glue upon which every healthy society depends. We value the imperatives of family and the cross-generational obligations that family implies. We value community, the neighborliness that expresses itself through raising the barn or coaching the soccer team. We value patriotism and the obligations of citizenship, a sense of duty and sacrifice on behalf of our nation. We value a faith in something bigger than ourselves, whether that something expresses itself in formal religion or ethical precepts. And we value the constellation of behaviors that express our mutual regard for one another. Honesty, fairness, humility, kindness, courtesy, and compassion. In every society, and in every individual, these twin strands, the individualistic and the communal, autonomy and solidarity, are in tension. And it has been one of the blessings of America that the circumstances of our nation's birth allowed us to negotiate these tensions better than most. We did not have to go through any of the violent upheavals that Europe was forced to endure as it shed its feudal past. Our passage from an agricultural to an industrial society was eased by the sheer size of the continent, vast tracts of land and abundant resources that allowed new immigrants to continually remake themselves. But we can't avoid these tensions entirely. At times, our values collide because in the hands of men, each one is subject to distortion and excess. Self-reliance and independence can transform into selfishness and license, ambition into greed and a frantic desire to succeed at any cost. More than once in our history, we've seen patriotism slide into jingoism, xenophobia, the stifling of dissent. We've seen faith calcify into self-righteousness, closed-mindedness, and a cruelty towards others. Finding the right balance between our competing values is difficult. Tensions arise not because we have steered a wrong course, but simply because we live in a difficult and contradictory world. I firmly believe, for example, that since 9/11, we've been fast and loose with constitutional principles in the fight against terrorism. But I acknowledge that even the wisest president and the most prudent Congress would struggle to balance the critical demands of our collective security against the equally compelling need to uphold civil liberties. I believe our economic policies pay too little attention to the displacement of manufacturing workers and the destruction of manufacturing towns. But I cannot wish away the sometimes competing demands of economic security and competitiveness. Unfortunately, too often in our national debates, we don't even get to the point where we weigh these difficult choices. Instead, we either exaggerate the degree to which policies we don't like impinge on our most sacred values, or play dumb when our own preferred policies conflict with important countervailing values. Conservatives, for instance, tend to bristle when it comes to government interference in the marketplace or their right to bear arms. Yet many of these same conservatives show little to no concern when it comes to government wiretapping without a warrant, or government attempts to control people's sexual practices. Conversely, it's easy to get most liberals riled up about government encroachments on freedom of the press or women's reproductive freedoms. But if you have a conversation with these same liberals about the potential costs of regulation to a small businessman, you will often draw a blank stare. In a country as diverse as ours, there will always be passionate arguments about how we draw the line when it comes to government action. That is how our democracy works. But our democracy might work a bit better if we recognize that all of us possess values that are worthy of respect. If liberals at least acknowledged that the recreational hunter feels the same way about his gun as they feel about their library books, and if conservatives recognized that most women feel as protective of their right to reproductive freedom as evangelicals are of their right to worship. Sometimes politicians and interest groups welcome conflict in pursuit of a broader ideological goal. Most anti-abortion activists, for example, have openly discouraged legislative allies from even pursuing those compromise measures that would have significantly reduced the incidence of partial birth abortion, because the image the procedure evokes in the mind of the public has helped them win converts to their position. And sometimes our ideological predispositions are just so fixed that we have trouble seeing the obvious. Once, while still in the Illinois Senate, I listened to a Republican colleague work himself into a lather over a proposed plan to provide school breakfasts to preschoolers. Such a plan, he insisted, would crush these children's spirit of self-reliance. I had to point out that not too many 5-year-olds I knew were self-reliant, but children who spent their formative years too hungry to learn could very well end up being charges of the state. Despite my best efforts, the bill still went down in defeat. Illinois preschoolers were saved from the debilitating effects of cereal and milk. But my fellow legislator's speech helps underscore one of the differences between ideology and values. Values are faithfully applied to the facts before us, while ideology overrides whatever facts call theory into question. I often wonder what makes it so difficult for politicians to talk about values in ways that don't appear calculated or phony. Partly, I think, it's because those of us in public life have become so scripted, and the gestures that candidates use to signify their values have become so standardized. The stop at a black church, the hunting trip, the visit to a NASCAR track, the reading in the kindergarten classroom, that it becomes harder and harder for the public to distinguish between honest sentiment and political stagecraft. Then there's the fact that the practice of modern politics itself seems to be value-free. Politics and political commentary not only allows but often rewards behavior that we would normally think of as scandalous. Fabricating stories, distorting the obvious meaning of what other people say, insulting or generally questioning their motives, poking through their personal affairs in search of damaging information. The gap between what we deem appropriate behavior in everyday life and what it takes to win a campaign is just one of the ways in which a politician's values are tested. In few other professions are you required, each and every day, to weigh so many competing demands between different sets of constituents, between the interests of your state and the interests of the nation, between party loyalty and your own sense of independence, between the value of service and obligations to your family. There's a constant danger that a politician loses his moral bearings and finds himself entirely steered by the winds of public opinion. Perhaps this explains why we long for that most elusive quality in our leaders, the quality of authenticity, of being who you say you are, of possessing a truthfulness that goes beyond words. My friend, the late U.S. Senator Paul Simon, had that quality. For most of his career in Illinois politics, he baffled the pundits by garnering support from people who disagreed, sometimes vigorously, with his liberal politics. It helped that he looked so trustworthy, like a small-town doctor, with his glasses and bow tie and basset hound face. But people also sensed that he lived out his values, that he was honest, and that he stood up for what he believed, and perhaps most of all, that he cared about them and what they were going through. That last aspect of Paul's character, a sense of empathy, is one that I find myself appreciating more and more as I get older. It is at the heart of my moral code, and it is how I understand the golden rule, not simply as a call to sympathy or charity, but as something more demanding, a call to stand in somebody else's shoes and see through their eyes. Like most of my values, I learned about empathy from my mother. She disdained any kind of cruelty or thoughtlessness or abuse of power, whether it expressed itself in the form of racial prejudice or bullying on the schoolyard or workers being underpaid. Whenever she saw even a hint of such behavior in me, she would look me square in the eyes and ask, "How do you think that would make you feel?" But it was in my relationship with my grandfather that I think I first internalized the full meaning of empathy. Because my mother's work took her overseas, I often lived with my grandparents during my high school years. And without a father present in the house, my grandfather bore the brunt of much of my adolescent rebellion. He himself was not always easy to get along with. He was at once warm-hearted and quick to anger, and in part because his career had not been particularly successful, his feelings could also be easily bruised. By the time I was 16, we were arguing all the time, usually about me failing to abide by what I considered to be an endless series of petty and arbitrary rules. Filling up the gas tank whenever I borrowed his car, say, or making sure that I rinsed out the milk carton before I put it in the garbage. With a certain talent for rhetoric, as well as an absolute certainty about the merits of my own views, I found that I could generally win these arguments, in the narrow sense of leaving my grandfather flustered, angry, and sounding unreasonable. But at some point, perhaps in my senior year, such victories started to feel less satisfying. I started to think about the struggles and disappointments he had seen in his life. I started to appreciate his need to feel respected in his own home. I realized that abiding by his rules would cost me little, but to him it would mean a lot. I recognized that sometimes he really did have a point, and that in insisting on getting my own way all the time, without regard to his feelings or needs, I was in some way diminishing myself. There's nothing extraordinary about such an awakening, of course. In one form or another, it is what we all must go through if we are to grow up. And yet I find myself returning again and again to that simple principle. How would that make you feel? As a guidepost for my politics. It's not a question we ask ourselves enough, I think. As a country, we seem to be suffering from an empathy deficit. We wouldn't tolerate schools that don't teach, that are chronically underfunded and understaffed and underinspired, if we thought that the children in them were like our children. It's hard to imagine the CEO of a company giving himself a multi-million-dollar bonus while cutting healthcare coverage for his workers, if he thought they were in some sense his equal. And it's safe to assume that those in power would think longer and harder about launching a war if they envisioned their own sons and daughters in harm's way. I believe a stronger sense of empathy would tilt the balance of our current politics in favor of those people who are struggling in this society. After all, if they are like us, then their struggles are our own. If we fail to help, we diminish ourselves. But that does not mean that those who are struggling, or those of us who claim to speak for those who are struggling, are thereby freed from trying to understand the perspectives of those who are better off. Black leaders need to appreciate the legitimate fears that may cause some whites to resist affirmative action. Union representatives can't afford not to understand the competitive pressures their employers may be under. I am obligated to try to see the world through George Bush's eyes, no matter how much I may disagree with him. That's what empathy does. It calls us all to task, the conservative and the liberal, the powerful and the powerless, the oppressed and the oppressor. We are all shaken out of our complacency. We are all forced beyond our limited vision. No one is exempt from the call to find common ground. Of course, in the end, a sense of mutual understanding isn't enough. After all, talk is cheap. Like any value, empathy must be acted upon. When I was a community organizer back in the 80s, I would often challenge neighborhood leaders by asking them where they put their time, energy, and money. Those are the true tests of what we value, I'd tell them, regardless of what we like to tell ourselves. If we aren't willing to pay a price for our values, if we aren't willing to make some sacrifices in order to realize them, then we should ask ourselves whether we truly believe in them at all. Chapter 3. Our Constitution. There's a saying that senators frequently use when asked to describe their first year on Capitol Hill. It's like drinking from a fire hose. The description is apt. For during my first few months in the Senate, everything seemed to be coming at me at once. I had to hire staff and set up offices in Washington and Illinois. I had to negotiate committee assignments and get up to speed on the issues pending before the committees. There was the backlog of 10,000 constituent letters that had accumulated since Election Day, and the 300 speaking invitations that were arriving every week. In half-hour blocks, I was shuttled from the Senate floor to committee rooms to hotel lobbies to radio stations, entirely dependent on an assortment of recently hired staffers in their 20s and 30s to keep me on schedule, hand me the right briefing book, remind me who I was meeting with, or steer me to the nearest restroom. Then, at night, there was the adjustment of living alone. Michelle and I had decided to keep the family in Chicago, in part because we liked the idea of raising the girls outside the hothouse environment of Washington, but also because the arrangement gave Michelle a circle of support from her mother, brother, other family and friends that could help her manage the prolonged absences my job would require. So for the 3 nights a week that I spent in Washington, I rented a small one-bedroom apartment near Georgetown Law School in a high-rise between Capitol Hill and downtown. At first, I tried to embrace my newfound solitude, forcing myself to remember the pleasures of bachelorhood gathering takeout menus from every restaurant in the neighborhood, watching basketball or reading late into the night, hitting the gym for a midnight workout, leaving dishes in the sink, and not making my bed. But it was no use. After 13 years of marriage, I found myself to be fully domesticated, soft, and helpless. My first morning in Washington, I realized I'd forgotten to buy a shower curtain and had to scrunch up against the shower wall in order to avoid flooding the bathroom floor. The next night, watching the game and having a beer, I fell asleep at halftime and woke up on the couch 2 hours later with a bad crick in my neck. Takeout food didn't taste so good anymore. The silence irked me. I found myself calling home repeatedly, just to listen to my daughter's voices, aching for the warmth of their hugs and the sweet smell of their skin. There were a handful of senators who also had young families, and whenever we met, we would compare notes on the pros and cons of moving to Washington, as well as the difficulty in protecting family time from overzealous staff. But most of my new colleagues were considerably older. The average age was 60. And so, as I made the rounds to their offices, their advice usually related to the business of the Senate. They explained to me the advantages of various committee assignments and the temperaments of various committee chairmen. They offered suggestions on how to organize staff, who to talk to for extra office space, and how to manage constituent requests. Most of the advice I found useful. Occasionally, it was contradictory. But among Democrats, at least, my meetings would end with one consistent recommendation. As soon as possible, they said, I should schedule a meeting with Senator Byrd, not only as a matter of senatorial courtesy, but because Senator Byrd's senior position on the Appropriations Committee and general stature in the Senate still gave him considerable clout. At 87 years old, Senator Robert C. Byrd was not simply the dean of the Senate. He had come to be seen as the very embodiment of the Senate. I'd already left a message with Senator Byrd's office requesting a meeting when I first had an opportunity to see him in person. It was the day of our swearing-in, and we had been in the old Senate chamber, a dark, ornate place dominated by a large gargoyle-like eagle that stretched out over the presiding officer's chair from an awning of dark blood-red velvet. The somber setting matched the occasion, as the Democratic caucus was meeting to organize itself after the difficult election and the loss of its leader. After the new leadership team was installed, Minority Leader Reid asked Senator Byrd if he would say a few words. Slowly, the senior senator rose from his seat, a slender man with a still thick, snowy mane, watery blue eyes, and sharp, prominent nose. For a moment he stood in silence, steadying himself with his cane, his head turned upward, eyes fixed on the ceiling. Then he began to speak, in somber, measured tones, a hint of the Appalachians, like a knotty grain of wood beneath polished veneer. I don't recall the specifics of his speech, but I remember the broad themes cascading out from the well of the old chamber in a rising Shakespearean rhythm. The clockwork design of the Constitution, and the Senate as the essence of that charter's promise. The dangerous encroachment, year after year, of the executive branch on the Senate's precious independence. The need for every senator to reread our founding documents, so that we might remain steadfast and faithful and true to the meaning of the Republic. As he spoke, his voice grew more forceful. His forefinger stabbed the air. The dark room seemed to close in on him, until he seemed almost a specter, the spirit of Senate's past, his almost 50 years in these chambers reaching back to touch the previous 50 years, and the 50 years before that, and the 50 years before that, back to a time when Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and Hamilton still roamed Congress's halls, and the city itself was still wilderness and farmland and swamp. Back to a time when neither I nor those who looked like me could have sat within these walls. Sitting there listening to the old man speak, I felt with full force all the essential contradictions of me in this new place, with its marble busts, its arcane traditions, its memories, and its ghosts. I pondered the fact that according to his own autobiography, Senator Byrd had received his first taste of leadership in his early 20s. As a member of the Raleigh County Ku Klux Klan, an association that he had long disavowed, an error he attributed, no doubt correctly, to the time and place in which he had been raised, but which continued to surface as an issue throughout his career. I thought about how he had joined other giants of the Senate, like William J. Fulbright of Arkansas and Richard Russell of Georgia, in Southern resistance to civil rights legislation. I wondered if this would matter to the liberals who now lionize Senator Byrd for his principled opposition to the Iraq War resolution, the MoveOn.org crowd, the heirs of the political counterculture the senator had spent much of his career disdaining. I wondered if it should matter. Senator Byrd's life, like most of ours, has been the struggle of warring impulses, a twining of darkness and light. And in that sense, I realized that he really was a proper emblem for the Senate, whose rules and design reflect the grand compromise of America's founding, the bargain between northern states and southern states, the Senate's role as a guardian against the passions of the moment, a defender of minority rights and state sovereignty, but also a tool to protect the wealthy from the rabble, and assure slaveholders non-interference with their peculiar institution. Stamped into the very fiber of the Senate, within its genetic code, was the same contest between power and principle that characterized America as a whole, a lasting expression of that great debate between a few brilliant, flawed men that had concluded with the creation of a form of government unique in its genius, yet blind to the whip and the chain. The speech ended. Fellow senators clapped and congratulated Senator Byrd for his magnificent oratory. I went over to introduce myself, and he grasped my hand warmly, saying how much he looked forward to sitting down for a visit. Walking back to my office, I decided I would unpack my old constitutional law books that night and reread the document itself. For Senator Byrd was right. To understand what was happening in Washington in 2005, to understand my new job, and to understand Senator Byrd, one needed to circle back to the start, to America's earliest debates and founding documents, to trace how they had played out over time, and make judgments in light of subsequent history. If you ask my 8-year-old what I do for a living, she might say I make laws. And yet, one of the surprising things about Washington is the amount of time spent arguing not about what the law should be, but rather what the law is. The simplest statute, a requirement, say, that companies provide bathroom breaks to their hourly workers, becomes the subject of wildly different interpretations, depending on who you're talking to: the congressman who sponsored the provision, the staffer who drafted it, the department head whose job it is to enforce it, the lawyer whose client finds it inconvenient, or the judge who may be called upon to apply it. Some of this is by design, a result of the complex machinery of checks and balances. The diffusion of power between the branches, as well as between federal and state governments, means that no law is ever final, no battle truly finished. There's always the opportunity to strengthen or weaken what appears to be done, to water down a regulation or block its implementation, to contract an agency's power with a cut in their budget, or to seize control of an issue where a vacuum has been left. Partly it's the nature of the law itself, for in the end, all laws are just words on a page, words that are often malleable, opaque, as dependent on context and trust and empathy as they are in a story or poem or promise to someone, words whose meaning are subject to constant erosion. When it came to questions of national security, in the post-9/11 era, for example, the White House stood fast against any suggestion that it was answerable to Congress or the courts. During the hearings to confirm Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, arguments flared over everything from the scope of Congress's resolution authorizing the war in Iraq to the willingness of executive branch members to testify under oath. During the debate surrounding the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez, I would review memos produced by the Attorney General's office that suggested the word torture might not encompass techniques like sleep deprivation or repeated suffocation that failed to induce, quote, severe pain, or transcripts that suggested the Geneva Convention did not apply to enemy combatants captured in a war in Afghanistan, opinions that the Fourth Amendment did not apply to U.S. citizens labeled enemy combatants and captured on U.S. soil. None of these issues are easy. Many are worthy of serious debate. Even more than the substantive policies that the White House and its congressional allies were pursuing, though, what troubled me was the process, or lack of process, by which they disposed of opposing views, the sense that the rules of governing no longer applied, and that there were no fixed meanings or standards to which we could appeal. It was as if those in power had decided that habeas corpus, or separation of powers, were niceties that only got in the way, that they complicated what was obvious, like the need to stop terrorists, or impeded what was right, and could therefore be disregarded, or at least bent to strong wills. The irony, of course, was that such disregard of the rules and the manipulation of language to achieve a particular outcome was precisely what conservatives had long accused liberals of doing. It was one of the rationales behind Newt Gingrich's contract with America, the notion that the Democratic barons who then controlled the House of Representatives consistently abused the legislative process for their own gain. It was the basis for the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, the scorn heaped on the sad phrase, "It depends on what the meaning of is is." It was the basis of conservative broadsides against liberal academics, those high priests of political correctness, it was argued, who refused to acknowledge any eternal truths or hierarchies of knowledge and indoctrinated America's youth with dangerous moral relativism. And it was at the very heart of the conservative assault on the federal courts. Gaining control of the courts generally, and the Supreme Court in particular, had become the holy grail for a generation of conservative activists. And not just, they insisted, because they viewed the court as the last bastion of pro-abortion, pro-affirmative action, pro-homosexual, pro-criminal, pro-regulation, anti-religious liberal elitism. According to these activists, liberal judges had placed themselves above the law, basing their opinions not on the Constitution, but on their own whims and desired results, finding rights to abortion or sodomy that did not exist in the Constitution, subverting the democratic process, and perverting the Founding Fathers' original intent. To return the courts to their proper role required the appointment of strict constructionists to the federal bench, men and women who understood the difference between interpreting and making laws. Those on the left saw the situation quite differently. With conservative Republicans making gains in the congressional and presidential elections, many liberals viewed the courts as the only thing standing in the way of a radical effort to roll back civil rights, women's rights, civil liberties, environmental regulation, church and state separation, and the entire legacy of the New Deal. During the Bork nomination, advocacy groups and Democratic leaders organized their opposition with a sophistication that had never been seen for a judicial confirmation. When the nomination was defeated, conservatives realized that they would have to build their own grassroots army. Since then, each side had claimed incremental advances and setbacks. Democrats complained loudly when Republicans used control of the Judiciary Committee to block 61 of Clinton's appointments to appellate and district courts. And for the brief time that they held the majority, the Democrats tried the same tactic on George W. Bush's nominees. But when the Democrats lost their Senate majority in 2002, they had only one arrow left in their quiver, a strategy that could be summed up in one word, the battle cry around which the Democratic faithful now rallied. Filibuster. The Constitution makes no mention of the filibuster. It is a Senate rule, one that dates back to the very first Congress. The basic idea is simple. Because all Senate business is conducted by unanimous consent, any senator can bring proceedings to a halt by exercising his right to unlimited debate and refusing to move on to the next order of business. In other words, he can talk for as long as he wants. So long as he or like-minded colleagues are willing to stay on the floor and talk, everything else has to wait, which gives each senator an enormous amount of leverage and a determined minority effective veto power over any piece of legislation. Throughout the Senate's modern history, the filibuster has remained a preciously guarded prerogative. One of the distinguishing features, it is said, along with six-year terms and the allocation of two senators to each state, regardless of population, that separates the Senate from the House and serves as a firewall against the dangers of majority overreach. There's another, grimmer history to the filibuster, though, one that carries special relevance for me. For almost a century, the filibuster was the South's weapon of choice in its efforts to protect Jim Crow from federal interference, the legal blockade that effectively gutted the 14th and 15th Amendments. Decade after decade, courtly, erudite men like Senator Richard B. Russell of Georgia used the filibuster to choke off any and every piece of civil rights legislation before the Senate, whether voting rights bills or fair employment bills or anti-lynching bills. With words, with rules, with procedures and precedent, with law, Southern senators had succeeded in perpetuating black subjugation in ways that mere violence never could. The filibuster hadn't just stopped bills. For many blacks in the South, the filibuster had snuffed out hope. Democrats used the filibuster sparingly in George Bush's first term. Of the president's 200-plus judicial nominees, only 10 were prevented from getting to the floor for an up or down vote. Still, all 10 were nominees to appellate courts, the courts that counted. All 10 were standard bearers for the conservative cause. And if Democrats maintained their filibuster on these 10 fine jurists, conservatives argued, there would be nothing to prevent them from having their way with future Supreme Court nominees. So it came to pass that President Bush, emboldened by a bigger Republican majority in the Senate and his self-proclaimed mandate, decided in the first few weeks of his second term to renominate 7 previously filibustered judges. As a poke in the eye to the Democrats, it produced the desired response. Democratic leader Harry Reid called it a big wet kiss to the far right and renewed the threat of a filibuster. Republicans, sensing that this was the time to go in for the kill, announced that if Democrats continued in their obstructionist ways, they would have no choice but to invoke the dreaded nuclear option, a novel procedural maneuver that would involve the Senate's presiding officer, perhaps Vice President Cheney himself, ignoring the opinion of the Senate parliamentarian, breaking 200 years of Senate precedent, and deciding with a simple bang of the gavel that the use of filibusters was no longer permissible under the Senate rules, at least when it came to judicial nominations. To me, the threat to eliminate the filibuster on judicial nominations was just one more example of Republicans changing the rules in the middle of the game. Moreover, a good argument could be made that a vote on judicial nominations is precisely the situation where the filibuster's supermajority requirement makes sense. Because federal judges receive lifetime appointments and often serve through the terms of multiple presidents, it behooves a president and benefits our democracy to find moderate nominees who can garner some measure of bipartisan support. Few of the Bush nominees in question fell into the moderate category. Rather, they showed a pattern of hostility towards civil rights, privacy, and checks on executive power that put them to the right of even most Republican judges. One particularly troubling nominee had derisively called Social Security and other New Deal programs, quote, the triumph of our own socialist revolution, unquote. Still, I remember muffling a laugh the first time I heard the term nuclear option. It seemed to perfectly capture the loss of perspective that had come to characterize judicial confirmations, part of the spin fest that permitted groups on the left to run ads featuring scenes of Jimmy Stewart's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, without any mention that segregationists Strom Thurmond and Jim Eastland had played Mr. Smith in real life. The shameless mythologizing that allowed Southern Republicans to rise on the Senate floor and somberly intone about the improprieties of filibusters, without even a peep of acknowledgement that it was the politicians from their states, their direct political forebears, that had perfected the art for a malicious cause. Not many of my fellow Democrats appreciated the irony. As the judicial confirmation process began heating up, I had a conversation with a friend in which I admitted concern with some of the strategies we were using to discredit and block appointees. I had no doubt of the damage that some of Bush's judicial nominees might do. I would support the filibuster of certain of these judges, if nothing else than to signal to the White House the need to moderate its next selections. But elections ultimately meant something, I said. Instead of relying on Senate procedures, there was one way to ensure that judges on the bench reflected our values, and that was to win at the polls. Do you really think that if the situation were reversed, Republicans would have any qualms about using the filibuster? My friend asked me. I didn't, and yet I doubted that our use of the filibuster would dispel the image of Democrats always being on the defensive, a perception that we used the courts and lawyers and procedural tricks to avoid having to win over popular opinion. In our reliance on the courts to vindicate not only our rights but also our values, I wondered if progressives had lost too much faith in democracy. Just as conservatives appear to have lost any sense that democracy must be more than what the majority insists upon. For 10 years before coming to Washington, I taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago. I loved the law school classroom, the stripped-down nature of it, the high-wire act of standing in front of a room at the beginning of each class with just blackboard and chalk, the students taking measure of me, some intent or apprehensive, others demonstrative in their boredom, the tension broken by my first question, "What's this case about?" and the hands tentatively rising, the initial responses and me pushing back against whatever arguments surfaced, until slowly the bare words were peeled back, and what had appeared dry and lifeless just a few minutes ago suddenly came alive, and my students' eyes stirred, the text becoming for them a part not just of the past, but of their present and their future. A careful reading of the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, and the Constitution reminds us just how much all our attitudes have been shaped by them. Take the idea of inalienable rights. More than 200 years after the Declaration of Independence was written and the Bill of Rights was ratified, we continue to argue about the meaning of reasonable search, or whether the Second Amendment prohibits all gun regulation, or whether the desecration of the flag should be considered speech. We debate whether such basic common law rights as the right to marry, or the right to maintain our bodily integrity, are implicitly, if not explicitly, recognized by the Constitution, and whether these rights encompass personal decisions involving abortion, or end-of-life care, or homosexual partnerships. And yet, for all our disagreements, we would be hard-pressed to find a conservative or liberal in America today, whether Republican or Democrat, academic or layman, who doesn't subscribe to the basic set of individual liberties identified by the founders and enshrined in our Constitution and our common law. The right to speak our minds, the right to worship how and if we wish, the right to peaceably assemble to petition our government, the right to own, buy, and sell property, and not have it taken away without fair compensation, the right not to be searched or detained by the state without due process, the right to a fair and speedy trial, and the right to make our own determinations with minimal restriction regarding family life and the way we raise our children. We consider these rights to be universal, a codification of liberty's meaning, constraining all levels of government and applicable to all people within the boundaries of our political community. Moreover, we recognize that the very idea of these universal rights presupposes the equal worth of every individual. In that sense, wherever we lie on the political spectrum, we all subscribe to the founders' teachings. We also recognize that a declaration is not a government. A creed is not enough. The founders recognized that there were seeds of anarchy in the idea of individual freedom, an intoxicating danger in the idea of equality. For if everybody is truly free, without the constraints of birth or rank or an inherited social order, then how can we ever hope to form a society that coheres? The solution that the founders arrived at, after contentious debate and multiple drafts, proved to be their novel contribution to the world. The outlines of Madison's constitutional architecture are so familiar that even schoolchildren can recite them. Not only rule of law and representative government, not just a Bill of Rights, but also the separation of the national government into three co-equal branches, a bicameral Congress, and a conception of federalism that preserved authority in state governments, all of it designed to diffuse power, check faction, balance interests, and prevent tyranny by either the few or the many. As with our understanding of the Declaration, we debate the details of constitutional construction. We may object to Congress's abuse of expanded Commerce Clause powers to the detriment of the states, or the erosion of Congress's power to declare war. But we are confident in the fundamental soundness of the founders' blueprints and the Democratic House that resulted. Conservative or liberal, we are all constitutionalists. So if we all believe in individual liberty, and we all believe in these rules of democracy, what is our modern argument about? If we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that much of the time we are arguing about results, the actual decisions that the courts and the legislature make about the profound and difficult issues that help shape our lives. Should we let teachers lead our children in prayer and leave open the possibility that the minority faiths of some children are diminished? Or do we forbid such prayer and force parents of faith to hand over their children to a secular world 8 hours a day? Is a university being fair by taking the history of racial discrimination and exclusion into account when filling a limited number of slots in its medical school? Or does fairness demand that universities treat every applicant in a colorblind fashion? More often than not, if a particular procedural rule, the right to filibuster, say, or a Supreme Court's approach to constitutional interpretation, helps us win the argument and upholds our position, then for that moment at least, we think it's a pretty good rule. If it doesn't help us win, then we tend not to like it so much. Of course, there's more at stake in our current debates about the Constitution and the proper role of the courts. We are also arguing about how to argue, the means, in a big, crowded, noisy democracy, of settling our disputes peacefully. We want to win, but most of us also recognize the need for consistency, predictability, and coherence. We want the rules to be fair. And so, when we get in a tussle about abortion or flag burning, we appeal to a higher authority, the Founding Fathers, to give us more direction. Some, like Justice Scalia, conclude that the Founding Fathers will tell us all that we need to know, and that if we strictly obey the rules they've laid out, for example, that the only rights protected in the Constitution are those that are written out in plain English, as understood by those who wrote them, then democracy is respected and fairness is achieved. Others, like Justice Breyer, don't dispute that the plain meaning of constitutional provisions matter, but they insist that sometimes the text can only take you so far, that on the truly hard cases, the truly big arguments, we have to take context, history, and the practical outcomes of a decision into account. According to this view, the Founding Fathers have told us how to think, but are no longer around to tell us what to think. We are on our own, and we have only reason and our judgment to rely on. Anyone like Justice Scalia, looking to resolve our modern constitutional dispute through strict construction, has one big problem. The founders themselves disagreed profoundly, vehemently, on the meaning of their masterpiece. Before the ink on the constitutional parchment was dry, arguments had erupted, not just about minor provisions, but about first principles. Not just between peripheral figures, but within the revolution's very core. They argued about how much power the national government should have to supersede state laws, to form a standing army, or to assume debt. They argued about the president's role in establishing treaties with foreign powers, and about the Supreme Court's role in determining the law. They argued about the meaning of such basic rights as freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And on several occasions, when the fragile state seemed threatened, they were not averse to ignoring those rights altogether. So if the founders themselves didn't agree, if strict construction will not work, then how do we determine what the Constitution should mean? The answer I settle on, which is by no means original to me, requires a shift in metaphors, one that sees our democracy not as a house to be built, but a conversation to be had. According to this conception, the genius of Madison's design is not that it provides us a fixed blueprint for action, the way a draftsman plots a building's construction. It provides us with rules, a framework, but fidelity to these rules will not guarantee a just society or assure agreement on what's right. What the rules and framework of our Constitution can do is organize the way by which we argue about our future. They force us into a conversation, a deliberative democracy, in which each and every citizen is required to engage in a process of testing his or her ideas against an external reality, persuading others to their point of view, and building shifting alliances of consent. The process requires us to persuade and not coerce. It forces us to entertain the possibility that we are not always right and to sometimes change our minds. It challenges us to examine our motives and our interests constantly and suggests that both our individual and collective judgments are at once legitimate and highly fallible. The historical record supports such a view. After all, if there was one impulse shared by all the founders, it was a rejection of all forms of absolute authority, whether the king, the theocrat, the general, the oligarch, the dictator, the majority, or anyone else who claims to make choices for us. But it's not just absolute power that the founders sought to guard against. Implicit in its structure, in the very idea of ordered liberty, was a rejection of absolute truth, the infallibility of any idea or ideology or theology or ism, any tyrannical consistency that might lock future generations into a single, unalterable course, or drive both majorities and minorities into the cruelties of the Inquisition, the pogrom, the gulag, or the jihad. The founders may have trusted in God, but true to the Enlightenment spirit, they also trusted in the minds and senses that God had